This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in. Around 5 years ago, Roger Thoreau was a correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, working on a book with a colleague about global hunger when he hit upon a mantra that would spark a shift in his career. As the book came out and his Outrage and Inspire effort was born, Thoreau left his position in Africa and at the newspaper where he'd worked for 3 decades and signed on at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs as Senior Fellow on Global Agriculture and Food Policy. It's in that role that he continues to work on hunger issues around the world, including here in the United States. His work more recently has grown to include another project on the importance of early nutrition called the 1,000 Days Project. He was in Milwaukee recently to talk about that work and stop by the Lake Effect studio, along with Magda Peck, the dean of the UWM School of Public Health. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
So you have this Outrage and Inspire project underway, and there are a lot of people out there who have dedicated time and resources to doing something about hunger around the world, but I gather one area in which you feel like you can especially contribute is in your ability to tell stories.
Yes, and thank you. I think that's a critical aspect of this, that as we look kind of back at books that had been written on this issue, a lot of them were kind of academic books, so they were like development textbooks, you know, for classroom studies. Or they were written by economists, and they're looking at things from 40,000 feet down. Or they were like polemics or screeds by somebody who's got an angle that they're really driving.
Trying to shame us into change.
Yeah, precisely. Or, you know, promoting some other aspect of op-ed, you know, this is really great or something. And we just figured that just the storytelling of particularly the people on the ground in the developing world, and in my case, especially in Africa, and when we're seeing all this come into play and the impact, say, of American policies, unintended in you know, consequences of, say, our farm bill or the way we did our food aid, the global trade of agriculture, really saw that come into play during the Ethiopian famine of 2003. And I wrote a lot about that for the Wall Street Journal. And that I think that impact and being able to tell those stories of here's these consequences and here's the people that are suffering by having brought hunger into the 21st century, and shame on us for doing that.
Well, and so where does the 1,000 Days Project fit into this dynamic?
Yeah, so it's kind of the progression of the reporting that I was doing. And say after the Ethiopian famine of 2003, or kind of in the midst of that, you know, I'd been, as I said, a foreign correspondent for the journal for close to 2 decades by that time, and doing and behaving as foreign correspondents do. You travel from country to country and place to place and story to story, and then, boom, you move on and you go to some other place. That story, the famine of Ethiopia in 2003, it was the first great famine, the first great hunger crisis of the 21st century, really stopped me cold. It was what was then inspiring my journalism, that this is one story that I cannot leave. I have to keep coming back to this story. So that was kind of, you know, when talks about kind of, you know, positive disruption or things, you know, both in, you know, technology or whatever. This in my life as a journalist, or my career as a journalist in my life, really changed things, that this is the one story I want to write about. So I wrote that first book with Scott on Enough, Why the World's Poor Suffer in an Age of Plenty. And then the second book I did, wanting to follow on that, was to really look at the smallholder farmers, again, particularly in Africa, who were kind of bearing the brunt of this neglect.
Explain the significance of smallholder farmers. I don't know that that's a term that everybody knows what it means.
Right. So smallholder farmers, different than, say, the concept here. Smallholder farmers, say, in an African context would be like maybe 3 acres that they would have, maybe kind of at the most, half acre, 1 acre, 2 acres. And it's on that small plot of land that they have to feed their families, and then hopefully have a surplus or something that they're able to sell for, you know, to improve their house, to diversify their farm, to pay for the kids' school education, to pay for the malaria medication, health issues. It's these smallholder farmers then, kind of because this neglect of agriculture development, you know, that kind of all the big development agencies in the world were kind of part of, including USAID and the British DFID, these farmers were kind of ignored, and people kind of said, you know, they're too poor, too remote, too small, too insignificant. Who kind of cares about them? They're not possible clients or customers, or what kind of market are they? So the result of all that was is that they were far behind farmers everywhere else in the world in terms of yields. Say, in comparison to American farmers, maybe their yields of corn or maize would be maybe one-tenth of what the farmers here would get on, say, per acre. Wheat, beans, you know, anything, the vegetables that they're growing, all really lagging behind. And the upshot of that was, which I think is perhaps the cruelest irony of Africa, is that Africa's hungriest people are her smallholder farmers. And it creates this bizarre and stupid and obscene oxymoron of hungry farmers.
And presumably this plays into the Thousand Days
right.
project because these hungry farmers are raising hungry children.
Exactly. And so it was kind of the progression then of the coverage of the Wall Street Journal in the first two books I did that then led me into the Thousand Days. And particularly looking at the importance of nutrition in those Thousand Days, so during a woman's pregnancy and the vital the necessity of the minerals and nutrients that the mom needs, and then in the first 2 years of a child's life, when the brain is growing, you know, most rapidly, and it's when stunting begins, the physical and mental stunting of a child begins at that stage. But a couple of the farm families that I was following then in the last hunger season, there were four farm families in western Kenya. A couple of the children in those families were manifestly malnourished. And there I saw that in this time of the hunger season, which is the period between when the food from the previous harvest runs out, is either consumed by the family or sold for whatever purposes for the income, and when the next harvest comes in. And that can be a period of, say, a couple of weeks, or in one of the farm families in the story, it stretched on for 9 or 10 months. So it's this period of profound deprivation. When the number of where food is rationed, the number of meals decline from 3 a day to 2 to 1, to some days basically nothing except maybe a weak cup of porridge in the morning or a cup of tea, you know, without sugar, and just kind of water with a little bit of tea flavor in it. And there, kind of in the midst of that, to see the deepest form of that misery, to be a mother who is raising a malnourished child, or to be a mother who cannot stop the crying of a malnourished and hungry child. And that then was then the beginning, while I was still reporting that book and finishing the writing of that, then thinking of what's next. And the Thousand Days movement was starting to form, the whole scaling up nutrition, international development starting to focus on this period and the impact for economies of countries, for the health of the world, for the individual health, that I figured, yeah, this would be something that I'd really concentrate on. And so for the Thousand Days, I'm following women starting at some stage in their pregnancy and then following through to second birthday to child in Uganda, India, Guatemala, and then in the U.S., and I'm following some families in Chicago.
And that really struck me that we think of nutrition, sadly, in the developing world as being a significant issue, but it is an issue in this country as well.
Absolutely. And that's why I wanted to include the United States, that it's just not a problem that's over there somewhere in those countries, but it's also a vital issue here. And then in Chicago, I was living in Chicago at the time when started this project, and so that was convenient. But also the issue that Chicago was dealing with and the research going on in terms of food deserts. The mayor at the time was, you know, closing schools in Chicago. You know, maybe one of the reasons for failed schools is because the children in that crucial time of development, maybe they're not getting the proper nutrition, so they're not even prepared to go to school in kindergarten and first grade when they start. And so, kind of setting up this path of failure.
As you look at this problem and look towards solutions, how much of what is needed do you think is technology? How much is money, and how much is willpower?
Willpower is a critical thing that people recognize this problem and say we've got to do something about it. And I think particularly as they would look at their comparative statistics of where Chicago or Milwaukee sits or Wisconsin or Illinois kind of sit on the national scale on these things, you would think that kind of the political leaders would say, my goodness, look where we're standing here. We can't have that. We have to be improved, particularly in this area where we're in the Midwest with the most fertile soils in the world. We're the breadbasket of the world. And we have these problems here, you know, kind of what's going on. But the other thing is, in terms of investments, I think it really shows that investments in women and investments in children are really important and need to be prioritized. And then also starting at this early stage, whether it's kind of early childhood education, nutrition information and education, the prenatal care. And the education information, it's just very simple and basic about the nutrients that are important, the importance of a diversified diet. And the interesting thing in my reporting is that is something that I'm hearing, whether it is being a midwife in Africa talking to a group of pregnant moms or moms with newborn infants who are sitting under a tree in Africa, or it's the instruction that's going on a veranda in a house in India, or in a little community center somewhere in Guatemala, or in a living room or a kitchen here in the United States. It's the same message and the same kind of basic education that goes on. The nutrition and also the sanitation, so the proper, you know, hand washing and sanitary environment where the moms are living and the kids are growing up, because that's really important for the for kind of the parasite load and just the cleanliness of things.
I want to bring Magda Peck in this conversation as well for this final question, and that is, who has to drive this change? And if you're listening to this in Milwaukee, you know, what's the role that someone in the community here plays in this whole equation?
Well, the first is to recognize there's no one thing we can do, so we can't just easily fix it. And one of the things I find about being in Milwaukee and in other cities is that we like the simple solution, and this does not have a simple solution, but it's not unsolvable. I think part of what's happening in Milwaukee is we tend to think about, well, we'll feed people. We'll give an extra box of Cheerios. We'll fill it up with surplus cans that I wasn't used for the last 6 months. That's not going to fix the problem. I think the big deal about doing something about it is to reframe it and recognize that it has a sense of urgency. So I love the 1,000 days approach because it says that we get to talk about what we're doing in infant mortality, what we're doing in early childhood education, and what we're doing about food deserts and food security all together. Right now, those conversations are happening in lots of different places. So first, I would say recognize that it is happening here. It's happening here with urgency, perhaps a quieter one. Recognize there isn't a single thing to do, and yes, bring that can to church, but know that that's not going to fix it, that it really is about understanding how food systems work and how we can work across our different initiatives in town so that when we're talking about infant mortality, we're talking about healthy nutrition, we're talking about early childhood education and school success, we're not just going to different meetings and not connecting the dots.
I think one of the key things there is the empowerment of women and moms, that they have a lot to say about this themselves. Empowerment of communities and neighborhoods around this, that, you know, we don't have – and when one sees this in some places like in India, you know, communities that I'm looking at are kind of gathering around the whole aspect of reducing infant mortality. Why are so many of our children dying under five or within the first month of life or something? You know, what can we do about that as mothers? But I think then kind of as a greater community as a whole for the political will, you said, and the politicians. But I think it's also so critical that, say, the business community gets involved in this because the impact falls directly on them eventually. This all catches up when you have the, say, undernourished or a slow development or undernourishment of a child and then the cognitive development that may lag because of that. That all comes through the school system and it ends up certainly in the workforce. And as the workforce becomes increasingly skilled and the tasks and jobs that are required, increasing education needed, increasing skills, this workforce is an educated and a skilled and a really cognitive developed workforce is really important.
There are so many assets to build on in Milwaukee. This is not a starting place, but this is a growing place. A real shout out needs to go not only to Growing Power and the Hunger Task Force and Fondy Food Market and Walnut Way and the Food Council. There is a movement happening in this city that is recognizing that it's not enough just to hand people a meal, but it goes back to growing food, supplying food. Healthy choice becomes the easy choice. And that's conversations that are happening in folks' kitchens, in local gardening plots, in Alice's garden. And it's something that is bubbling up. So this notion of local empowerment is there. What's needed is to have a shared vision and the fact that we need to be doing more now and it can be done. So inspire, yes, but a little outrage could go a long way. We have our own hunger season. Our hunger period here is the period when the food stamps run out and the next check doesn't come yet.
Yeah,
when you, it's when the refrigerator is going on empty. We have our own hunger season from when kids go home from a food program where they're able to get reduced school lunches and be fed breakfast. And they're stuffing their pockets to be able to then have enough food in their backpacks on the weekend, or we send them home with fruit. That's the quiet hunger season, is the weekends or the summer when school's out. We should say that is not on our watch.
Magda Peck, Roger Thurow, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Roger Thurow is Senior Fellow on Global Agriculture and Food Policy at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, creator of the Outrage and Inspire Project, and author of two books, including Enough, Why the World's Poorest Starve in an Age of Plenty. He grew up just down the road in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Magda Peck is Dean of the Zilber School of Public Health at UW-Milwaukee. Two stories that connect the fashion world to bigger issues when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.